Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show by turning our attention to oceans. Life on Earth and other planets as well is only possible because of the presence of oceans. And that's why we study them. And we have some folks who are doing studies on oceans. And here to talk about her research on our oceans is Hannah Zanowski. Hannah's an assistant professor. She's in the UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And you will probably recall we have regular guests the last Monday of every month, our weather guys from that same department, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. So she's a member of that department. She's also a member of the Advisory Council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. And I'm going to ask her some more about that as we move along, too. So we'll talk with her about what oceans can tell us about, maybe about the past, maybe about our future. And you can join the conversation as well. And I hope you will. You can call us. The number's 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Hannah Zanowski, welcome. Thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you very much. I'm super excited to be here.
So you study oceanography. What the heck is that?
So I am a physical oceanographer, which means that I study basically how the ocean works, how it moves, and how it changes over time.
And the focus of your research is polar.
Yes, it is.
And paleo.
And paleo.
Or oceanography. Okay, so.
And exoplanets.
How the heck, how did you get involved in all this or interested? What's your background that led to this?
So I was always actually interested in astronomy from a young age. I originally wanted to do astrophysics growing up. This has always been a theme for me. And then in undergrad, I double majored in math and physics, and stumbled across oceanography by taking this huge 1,000-person oceanography class. And I had a professor who was absolutely amazing, and I fell in love with the ocean because of that. So I ended up studying the ocean instead as a result, but my interest in astronomy never truly left me, so I've just found my way back into exoplanet science because we're at this point now where we can kind of think about climate on planets outside of our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bit about how I ended up here.
So, and you did your research at Princeton, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I got my PhD at Princeton University in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So I studied, I got into polar oceanography there mostly, where I was actually studying the Southern Ocean, which is the ocean that surrounds Antarctica, and specifically thinking about how changes in the surface Southern Ocean are communicated to the very deep parts of the global ocean. And I use a bunch of climate models to look at that. So climate models are just millions and millions of lines of computer code that help us model Earth and in its past and potentially in its future as well.
So how does the, let's take the Arctic then, since that's your kind of your,
it's bread and butter nowadays.
Your favorite. How does the Arctic Ocean behave under changing climate conditions?
Yeah, so right now, the biggest thing about the Arctic in terms of how it's changing is how much sea ice is covering the Arctic Ocean. Right? So sea ice is just frozen ocean itself, and so it melts throughout the course of the year and then refreezes in the winter. But the total amount of sea ice that's covering the Arctic Ocean has reduced over time, especially in the satellite era or thinking about even before then, that has changed a bunch. Right? And so,
how big is that area, by the way? I mean, is it the size of Texas, the two sides?
Several millions of square kilometers. Yeah, maybe something like that. That's probably a little bit big. I should be a little careful here number-wise in terms of sea ice, since I think more about the ocean. But yes, it's quite a large reduction in sea ice area. So it's not totally gone, but we're moving toward potentially having summers in the Arctic where we're mostly ice-free, maybe by mid-century or so. And so what we mean by that, ice-free from a scientific perspective, is less than a million square kilometers. So still ice, but a lot less cover than there used to be. And so ice cover is really important for thinking about how the ocean moves, because ice is really good. Here, I'm getting stuck in my cords here. Ice is really good at damping interaction between the atmosphere and the ocean. So the atmosphere and the ocean are always talking to each other in terms of exchanging gases. The atmosphere forces the ocean. And what we mean by that is when the winds blow over the ocean, they move the water around. That's what drives our surface currents that you might be familiar with, like the Gulf Stream, things like that. There are currents in the Arctic Ocean as well, right? And so when you get rid of sea ice, you kind of make it easier for the atmosphere and the ocean to kind of interact with each other, and you also make it easier to sort of change the dynamics, or basically how the circulation works within the Arctic itself. So big thing is reduction of sea ice. Also, temperatures are just increasing overall in the Arctic as well, which is why the sea ice is partly going away, right? Yeah. So fundamentally different from what it normally is.
Thinking about Lake Mendota here on campus, and 100 years or so of research on when the ice starts and when it goes out.
Right.
And it's narrowing.
Right, reducing the season for freeze up and thaw, right?
Yeah, and from the sound of it, then the same thing is happening.
That is also happening in the Arctic, yes. So the melt season is starting earlier. And then the freeze-up is starting later, right? So the overall time at which you actually have sea ice present in the Arctic Ocean, or thick sea ice, is getting smaller as well. So you're changing sort of the seasonal cycle of the Arctic, too.
So what's happening then is with the oceans when this amount of ice decreases, do the oceans, I'm guessing they absorb more solar energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when you get rid of ice, so ice, the other impact that sea ice has is that it's, since it's white, it's very reflective, right? So when you get rid of ice, the ocean is dark, so it actually absorbs more solar, incoming solar energy. And so that helps warm the ocean. And so a warming ocean behaves differently than something that's a little bit colder, right? Like I said, you can change the circulation, but a warmer ocean also takes up more volume, right? It takes up more space, right,
okay,
than a colder ocean at the same, you know,
yeah,
same mass. So this is an important component of sea level rise, is actually just the thermal component of warming the ocean up. It's not just that we dump ice from the continents into the ocean. It's also this thermal piece as well.
So the effect of that, of course, is higher ocean level, water levels. And does it affect the temperatures and the, and the way the atmosphere operates?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, that feeds back on the atmosphere, which then feeds back on the ocean and so on down the road, right? And so you kind of get into these sort of positive feedback loops where one sort of mechanism reinforces the other, and that moves your ocean or part of your ocean or bits of your climate into a different state, right?
Yeah, so you study, I mean, you study the polar oceans. You've probably at least looked at the equatorial oceans. Do they behave differently?
They most certainly do. Well, right, they're not ice covered, right? So they're not going to be subject to the same sort of ice cover dynamics as as in the polar regions. I don't spend too much time thinking about them these days, but they're going to be really important for things like large-scale climate patterns like the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or El Niño, right, which actually does impact Wisconsin to some degree. Dan Vimon is a great person to talk to about this, who's also in my department. So kind of thinking about the feedbacks between the atmosphere and the ocean, the equatorial regions are really, really quite important.
So how has the circulations, I don't know if you can answer this.
Go for
it. How's the circulation of the oceans on Earth affected the evolution of life on our planet?
That is a big question.
That's a very big question. That's why I've hesitated to even bring it up.
No, it's fine. That's the question I would like to answer, right? So that's part of what really guides my research, is trying to understand what the ocean, the physical ocean's role is in either setting up, you know, or kind of creating a good environment for the sort of precursors for life, or in thinking about how do I want to say this? Basically, how that circulation then perhaps impacted the evolution of life on our planet. So, you can kind of think about this. There are time periods where if the ocean circulation slows down, and this could be thinking about in the deep past, like many hundreds of millions of years ago, when we may have been a fully glaciated, fully ice-covered planet, right? Your ocean mm-hmm. circulation is going to be really, really different at that time. You're going to have much less exchange with the atmosphere. You're not going to have a lot of renewal between the atmosphere and the ocean. And that makes it harder for life to do its thing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how we like to think about this. And so that's maybe one example about thinking about, you know, snowball type Earth, but Earth has changed so much from a climate perspective over the, you know, it's 4.5, give or take, billion year history. So billion with a B, right? Mm-hmm. And the ocean has existed for over 4 billion years on this planet. Which is incredible. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of my new favorite facts about the ocean is that it's incredibly ancient and almost as ancient as our planet. So I want to think about basically how changes in circulation over these many billions and billions of years in these different time periods sort of interacted with life on our planet or made it easier for life to potentially take hold. And so, like I said, I'm not a biologist or a chemist, so I don't really do that piece, but I'm coming at it from trying to understand that physical environment and how that then sets things up to make life happy possible. Or not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Willem in Colfax has a question for you. Let's go there.
All right, let's
Willem.
Do it.
Hi. I wondered if, you know, with the current political system in our country and the leadership of the president calling climate change a hoax and the cuts to all kinds of science in regards to climate change and its effects, how does that affect your scientific work, and what's your opinion about the idea that climate change is a hoax?
Mm-hmm. Really appreciate that question. It is not a hoax. That's it. Full stop. Climate change is real. You are experiencing it right now, and you will continue to experience it unless we actually stop burning fossil fuels. From a funding perspective, this is what's happening right now is deeply problematic for the research that I do, especially thinking about the Arctic Ocean and how that might change in the future. Basically, all of my colleagues in my department are impacted by this to some degree. And depending on what the fallout is when we finally pass a budget, it could be really, really dire, like extremely detrimental to what we do. And the reality is if we just stop doing it here, that's not going to make it better. We just won't know better. So I think that's maybe the most direct thing that I can say. But yes, it has thrown us all for quite a loop. It's a lot of hurry up, scramble, try to figure out plan A, B, C, D, and then some new piece of information drops where you're like, all right, I have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how I'm going to, you know, potentially protect my students, right? So my grants fund my students mostly. Mm-hmm. They fund people who are trying to do PhDs or master's degrees in these fields because they want to make the world a better place. And they're interested in understanding the Earth. And so I think a world or at least a United States in which we don't do that really harms us all.
Hannah Zanowski, our guest today, assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and she also serves on the advisory council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. As we talk with her about her ocean research, I hope you'll join in as well with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about robotic space rovers and how to get them unstuck from the surface of the moon and elsewhere with our guest Dan Negroot from Mechanical Engineering at UW-Madison. But right now, we're taking a look at the ocean research being done by Hannah Zanowski from UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And again, join in with your own questions, comments at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. Hannah, you mentioned modeling earlier. Let's get into that a little bit more. How do you use models, or how are they used in this kind of research?
Yeah, so there's lots of different types of models. The one I use are these big, honkin', fully coupled climate models. And what that means is they have individual components for the atmosphere, the ocean, the land, and the plants on it, as well as ice sheets. So the ice that's actually on top of land. So ice sheets are over Antarctica, Greenland, for example, right now. As well as some models, like Earth system models, will also have biogeochemistry in them as well. So that's thinking about biology and chemistry together in the ocean atmosphere components to some degree. And then sea ice is the other really important piece of this. So we put all these things together and we can use them then. It's a sort of, all they're doing at the end of the day is trying to integrate these equations of how the Earth works forward in time, or, you know, thinking about in the past as well. So we use them for a variety of questions, especially to try and understand what our future world will look like if, for example, we continue to burn fossil fuels at the rates that we do, or maybe we increase that rate, or maybe we go through some sort of mitigation process over the course of the century. And they're kind of this tool we have to look at these big picture changes. And so say we'll run them out to the end of the 21st century. So in year 2100, you know, what's the average global air temperature going to be at the surface, right? So the place where we live, right? We can ask things like that. You can ask how much sea ice, you know, might be left in the Arctic if I'm curious about that, right? Or what areas are going to be so hot, for example, or so humid that, you know, large swaths of the population, you know, on our planet might be impacted that, like in the tropics. You can ask many, many different questions. You can diagnose how the ocean circulation might change. All of those pieces are in there as well. So that's what we do.
So if you plug in temperature increase, let's say, or you plug in something in a change, And then the model kind of recalibrates? Is that
that's
kind of how it works?
Kind of how you think about it. You won't necessarily plug in a temperature change. I mean, you could. You can say, okay, I want sometimes, for example, like, let's say we take what our modern day carbon dioxide levels are right now, which are something like 420 parts per million. We'll say, let's run this forward in time until that, you know, we force this with until this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has doubled from what it is, right? So often it's external parameters like that, and then we let the model run forward in time and then tell us sort of this is what things might look like, right? So at the end of the day, like I said, they're still just following these basic physical equations. It's just that, you know, they're written up in computer code and it's allowed to sort of behave in the way that it will. And you get these very different sort of solutions because the Earth is inherently we can describe the Earth and its sort of behavior by very complex equations that are inherently chaotic.
So if you plug that description or that example that you used into the computer, mm-hmm. how long does it take to plug it in, and how long does it take to get the... I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's a great question.
How long does it take for the computer to...
to spit something out. It actually takes quite a bit of real time. It also depends on the resolution of your model. So we're not... When we model the Earth like this, we actually have to what we call discretize our equations, which means we model the Earth as like points on a grid, right? So thinking about like latitude or longitude or something like that, right? And the finer or closer those points are together, or the finer your grid, the longer in general it takes, because there's just more steps within the process of all these different processors and things in the computer that are talking to each other. And the more you add, more processes that you add in each of the components of your system adds to that. So for example, if you want, you need to kind of run a climate model for a period of time when you start it from scratch to get up to something we call steady state, quote unquote, which is just the, you know, things are not changing a ton anymore. So they're kind of reaching its like mean or average state. And typically for most climate models, because the ocean likes to do things slowly, this, you need at least 1,000 years of model runtime to do that. That's not 1,000 real human years. otherwise we'd be here for, you know, we wouldn't be very good at our job, right? But, that can take, depending on the model, can take, you know, weeks to months of real time. Like, it's a pretty serious endeavor.
Computers are
You need supercomputers. Yeah, supercomputers are the way to go. So you need, like, many, you know, thousands of processors or cores to kind of, or hundreds of them, depending on the model, right, to do that. So it takes a lot to run that.
It sounds like it. Well, Dot in Manitowoc has a question for you. So let's go there. Dot, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. What is the explanation of global warming when the glaciers in Wisconsin melted? We certainly didn't have any cars or what was the explanation for that?
Sure.
Yeah, so you mean like when the last sort of glaciers actually retreated from where they were when they were kind of hanging out here in Wisconsin, like, you know, at the last glacial maximum 15,000 years ago. Yeah, so it was still an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what was happening by and large is that there was a lot of carbon dioxide actually stored in the ocean. And then over time, as things kind of slowly come out of that state, right, the ocean is more vigorous, it exchanges more with the atmosphere, and it sort of brings some of that back out. So it's kind of an important piece for that. It also draws down the carbon as well, so you can kind of put things in there. But CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and so what that basically means is that it kind of helps warm our atmosphere, right? And so that's part of it in terms of that time period is kind of how I would...
So it warmed a bit, and the CO2 then that escaped from the ice...
Or the ocean. And that has a feedback in the atmosphere where you continue to warm then, and then you melt your ice back, and then you continue to warm, right? And so the ocean itself can take up or outgas carbon depending on what the circulation is. So you either bring it into the ocean, right? So CO2 dissolves as a gas, or you can spit it back out. And the timescales over which that happen are really variable. So things like glacial and interglacial cycles, so we're thinking about like many thousands of years, like this question that Dot was asking, it is related to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's not the only thing, but that's kind of a big question for it. Yeah. Right? So it wasn't people that kicked us necessarily out of that, but the Earth also has these, you know, periods of change that are natural in addition to what we're doing to it now.
Yeah, and so we're just speeding up the process.
Yes. What we've been doing is, in the last, like, 200 years-ish since the pre-industrial era, is unprecedented in the last 800,000.
have made a big difference.
Yes, it's huge.
Yeah. So John wants to know, how do ocean temperatures and currents affect the climate, say, in the upper Midwest?
In the upper Midwest. All right. So I don't think too much about this here. Like I said, I think the biggest things are going to be that when you, like in the tropics, where we were talking about El Nino earlier, right? Mm-hmm. Changes within the Pacific Ocean are actually sort of spread out across the planet through what we call atmospheric teleconnections. All right. So the Pacific Ocean talks to the atmosphere, and then the atmosphere goes and kind of talks to its other parts in other places. Right. So sometimes climate in the Midwest can then be impacted by that. But also in terms of just how, when you change the ocean circulation overall, you are kind of fundamentally changing what the global average surface temperature is. And that is going to impact then maybe a little bit what we feel in Wisconsin. But the details of that, though, are very dependent on other factors that might influence it more. So the ocean matters a lot, but it's not necessarily, you know, every single day.
Yeah.
I don't want you to think that, like, how do I want to say this? That, you know, if you have a bad storm here right now, that was the oceans, you know, doing that. It's just that overall, on average, its role is to sort of impact planetary climate as a whole. And then that does actually feed back down at this very regional level at which we live.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So is that a...
Yeah, it makes good sense. Hannah Zanowski, our guest today, you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You're looking at exoplanet oceans.
Yes, I am.
Why the heck would you want to do that?
So because why stop at one ocean?
Yeah, so what's out there that's going to make a difference here?
What's all that's going to make a difference here? Well, I'm interested in oceans on exoplanets because I am fundamentally interested in this question about, are we alone in the universe?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so we know that life got started on this planet. We don't actually know how that happened. Mm-hmm. And so the hope is that by studying Earth and studying planets elsewhere, we might be able to answer some of those questions, but especially the are we alone bit. And I think, I mean, maybe I'm biased since I am an oceanographer, but I have a sense that oceans are going to be a really important piece of that puzzle simply because of the amount of liquid water that they can hold, right? And the fact that oceans themselves can be really stable features or stabilizing features of a planet's climate, which I think is important for long-term. So for a planet to sort of behave similarly over very, very long periods of time, and I do fundamentally think that's important for life to take hold, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you think about it, like life on our planet formed potentially up to like 4.1-ish billion years ago, at least definitely by 3.5 billion or 3.8 billion years ago. But it was very primitive microbial life for a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of need an environment where things don't get too wild necessarily, or at least something that can help bring your environment back to normal with all of these major climate changes that were happening. You know, Earth was a really violent place early on. You know, you're thinking about when it cools off, just geologically speaking, like volcanism, all of these things, some of these mass extinctions we've had in the last like 500 million years or so are related to major changes to the Earth system itself, to the climate, to things like volcanism. Not obviously the case of the dinosaurs, where it was an external asteroid impact, right? But many of the other ones were actually just related to Earth going through periods of unrest. So,
yeah. Jim in Webster has a question. Mm-hmm. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Pleased to be here. I just read a book about the Milankovitch cycles from the Serbian scientist, and he kind of worked out that the tilt of the Earth varies, and then the roundness of the orbit varies from very round to fairly egg-shaped, and then when the maximum temperature in the northern hemisphere occurs in terms of distance to the sun, and it's weird because right now we are closest to the sun for the northern hemisphere for our winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I can't remember. It's one's 20,000-year cycle. One's they're kind of overlapping cycles that aren't lined up necessarily with each other. A lot of it has to do with, of course, old man Jupiter out there tugging on the whole solar system. So
yeah.
I just thought maybe that'd be an interesting point to bring up. But I'll listen.
Okay, thanks for calling. Comments, Hannah?
Yeah, so Milankovitch cycles, you're exactly right. You did pretty well on the numbers. They're about 20,000 to 23,000 years, 40,000 to 43,000 years. So one of them's the obliquity, like you're talking about, the tilt of the Earth's axis, right? And then there's precession, which is sort of relating to how the Earth rotates around its own axis as related to that tilt as well. That one's a little bit complicated to explain, so we're just going to kind of sweep it under the rug right now. At least complicated to explain without lots of, you know, diagrams. And then the last one is eccentricity, right? Which is that how circular or you know, elliptical your orbit is, right? And those do also impact climate on those long-term glacial, interglacial timescales. So you're exactly right about that, and we factor that in when we think about climate and climate change. So when I said that, you know, what we're doing to our planet right now is unprecedented, at least in the last 800,000 years, we have ice cores that give us a record of sort of what gases in the atmosphere were like during those time periods, because the bubbles get trapped in the ice over time. And then we use that as a proxy for understanding what atmospheric temperature, for example, was in those periods. And what we see are these very big, long-term sort of dips and increases in temperature like that. And those are very clear indications of Milankovitch cycles, right? And so, yes, definitely that's part of this, and it's something we think about all the time. So, yeah, great job picking up on that and remembering all the numbers. So,
good job.
So like, yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bruce in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. My question is that Earth is kind of unusual in that we have a very large moon that creates a lot of tidal stirring of the ocean. So I've been wondering how much effect that has had on the development of life in the oceans and the currents and so on.
Yes, that's another great question. And yes, it is unusual in that regard. And so the moon, when it first formed, was a lot closer to our planet, right? And it has slowly sort of drifted away. And that's sort of turned into sort of energy that's like our planet is slowly, you know, increasing or decreasing its rotation rate here, right? And so there are some studies that, you know, would indicate that the moon has been a really important piece of potentially life developing on our planet, or at least potentially an important factor, right? We can't definitively say that, like, yeah, if we didn't have a moon, we wouldn't have life on this planet or anything like that, right? But it is really important, just like you're saying, because it's important for tides, right? And so tides are a way, especially in the ocean, they diffuse, diffusing heat in the ocean by impacting sort of the stretching, shrinking of our planet, squashing here. And then, how do I want to say this, right? So you actually dissipate a lot of heat in the ocean because of tides. And there's this kind of a nice energy source and a way to keep things relatively warm or warmer than they maybe would be if you didn't necessarily have as strong of a tidal forcing because of the moon. And keeping things, like I said, in that kind of warm state is nice, especially early on. So remember when we think about the Earth's, you know, once it kind of cooled off a bit from its really like Hadean period, which is this really like fiery, awful time period, hence why it's called the Hadean, you have an ocean that maybe behaves kind of like it does today. And then you have that tidal forcing. So at this time period, though, maybe 4 billion years ago, the sun was a lot fainter than it was today, which means you have less incoming solar radiation, which means you have a colder planet overall, right? And so we still think we had a liquid water ocean in that time period for a lot of reasons. Part of it is we invoke greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, but tides are potentially one small piece of that that kind of help keep things from freezing over, right? So they're an important part of energy dissipation, but they're also really important for, just kind of thinking about how stuff can then live in the ocean.
So you said the moon's was moving away from us. It's not going away anytime soon, I wouldn't imagine.
I don't think so, but it is definitely drifting away from us. It's, I mean, like at some point, I don't know. You got to ask the astronomers about that. I shouldn't speak too much to that. We get in trouble here. Somebody's going to bust in here and be like, no.
Well, sometimes people call and say, no, you're wrong about that.
That's fine. But I will invite them to come in here and try to talk without saying anything completely incorrect for an hour.
Bruce, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jake in Watertown, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just heard the guest mention the ice kind of playing its role to reflect solar radiation. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if the Earth's magnetic field weakening gets incorporated into the computer models at all, as that could possibly be maybe the largest piece of the puzzle here.
No, we don't really think, at least in Earth system models, about the weakening of the magnetic field. So that is definitely a thing, but that isn't necessarily going to impact the amount of solar radiation that the surface receives, right? Those two things aren't necessarily connected to each other. It's true that if you weaken the magnetic field or totally get rid of it, it suddenly doesn't protect us from a lot of really harmful space environment things, like what the sun is trying to blast at us all the time. And you don't really want to be exposed to that kind of radiation because it would be really terrible. But that's not something that we necessarily incorporate in our climate models, although there are models of sort of Earth's upper atmosphere that I imagine kind of think a little bit more about these things. But it isn't something that we necessarily are saying is like, oh, this is the smoking gun for what's happening here, because it's not.
Hmm. Jake, thanks. Jane in Lancaster, we'll go to you. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I was wondering if there is any benefit to having all the plastic in the oceans that is dumped there regularly, probably daily, and if the scientist is concerned about the people in Pakistan who've developed a way to consume plastic.
I'm not sure about it. Could you say a little bit more about I'm not sure.
Yeah, they found a fungal thing that will eat plastic.
Oh.
And, you know, we are loaded up with plastic in the oceans because it's dumped there.
Yeah.
And I understand that the fish and other animals that live in the ocean are using the plastic in their bodies, and we are too.
Yes. So microplastics, right, is probably what you've heard of. There's tons of plastic in the ocean. There's these huge garbage patches in the Central Pacific and Central Atlantic Ocean because our plastic ends up in the ocean. That's generally really harmful for anything that where it ends up, right? You, me, anything that lives in the ocean that's eating that, right? And I think, yeah, I don't know a ton about the research on the bacteria that potentially, or whatever it is, that potentially eat plastic, or like what the capacity they have for breaking that down and helping sort of solve the problem, right? It could be an option, but sort of to get that to scale, I don't even know what that would look like. Also, I think the bigger thing is that we need to kind of think about single-use plastic or think about better ways to not sort of generate so much of this or reuse it in a way that it's not ending up in huge quantities in the ocean, right? It's sort of major shifts in behavior in terms of what we're doing on our planet that aren't sustainable.
Jane, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to the moon drift here for just a minute, because I got a report here. Scientists determine the rate at which the moon is drifting away from Earth. They figured that out, I guess, during the Apollo missions. NASA did. Scientists estimate the moon is straying from the Earth by about an inch and a half per year, roughly the rate at which fingernails grow.
Right.
According to NASA, and as far as will the Earth ever lose its moon, we would actually lose the moon before the sun turns into a red giant.
That's what I was wondering. I don't know. Yeah, time period wise. Okay, so the moon might go first.
On that happy note, a reminder that we're talking today about the oceans.
I know, right?
And looking, well, we got into exoplanets too with our guest, Hannah Zanowski. And you can join in too. Question, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to Home Inspector John Freiberger about dealing with mold in your home. And you know, there's going to be a lot of mold in a lot of homes here in Wisconsin after that flooding this past week. So I think it's pretty timely. We'll also talk about mass timber as building material. UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor Alex Timmer along for that. That's tomorrow. Right now, we're taking a look at ocean research, both oceans in our world and in other worlds as well, with our guest Hannah Zanowski, Assistant Professor in the UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and also serves on the Advisory Council for the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. Happy to have her with us. Questions for her, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. And maybe talk a little bit more about I know you've got a grant to study Hycean planets, or Hycean, I guess you can pronounce it either way, Hycean planets. But before we talk about that, just tell us a little more about the Wisconsin Center for Origins Research. Who's all involved in that?
Lots of folks. So WICOR is how we call it. Officially became a thing in the fall of last year. And what it is it's just several departments and then individual scientists from other departments that came together because we want to ask these questions about origins, right? So origins of life on our planet, but then are we alone in the universe, right? And so it has major questions like how does a habitable planet form? How does it behave, right? All the way out to thinking about the unique sort of chemical biological pieces of this as well. So we bring our founding departments here, and I'm probably going to get these wrong, is astronomy, atmospheric, there's six founding departments, astronomy, atmospheric, and oceanic sciences. I think botany, bacteriology, geoscience, and chemistry. And if I've lied to you about that, some department's going to be very angry at me, and I'm sorry. So we all came together because we all have these same interests in understanding them, a fundamental question, but every single department and every single research scientist who's interested in this understands fundamentally that they only hold one piece of the puzzle. And that it's this really interdisciplinary type of work where you're translating across these different fields, where I'm trying to understand chemistry at all. And somebody else is telling me about, you know, sort of prebiotic, whatever, nutrients, where we all need to kind of get together in the same room and figure out how to talk to each other and figure out how each of us has the little bits of knowledge that help us, again, put that puzzle together. And so that is why CORE's mission is to really do that. And so we have a really, really neat set of scientists and folks who are involved within this center, and it's there to ask and answer big questions.
Yeah. Well, it's a cool way to do it because we do get siloed, you know.
Yes, a ton.
On this campus. I can speak from some experience on that myself. So it's nice to be able to put people together in a group like that from all those different perspectives. And so you've got a grant to study Hycean planets or Hycean. Yeah. How do you pronounce it, by the way?
I pronounce it Hycean, but I've been told by the person who sort of wrote the first paper on this. I mean, I haven't been told this directly, but I think they pronounce it Hycean. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Pick whatever you want.
It's H-Y.
You don't always get to decide. So
it's just H-Y-C-E-A-N.
Yeah. So it's like hydrogen atmosphere or hydrogen helium atmosphere. So very light gases over a very deep liquid water ocean is this sort of type of planet that is potentially out there in the universe that may be a really good candidate for hosting life just because of necessarily its deep oceans, but in terms of having a relatively large habitable zone around host stars.
How many of those have we found?
Not many.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that we've... There's one that we think might be falling properly into this category. I think what's really hard about this is that mostly these are theorized planets in the sense that based on how you do an internal structure modeling, which is basically just sort of fitting a bunch of curves to say, if this is the mass and the radius of a planet, and again, the astronomers might get me in trouble here. Sorry, folk. If this is the mass and the radius of a planet, these are the sort of potential sort of atmosphere or, you know, rock or, you know, core or liquid water ocean or whatever potential sort of features that could exist to explain that relationship. And so there's no exoplanet that we can directly image an ocean on. So we don't have any direct evidence that there is truly an ocean. It's just based on sort of what might be in the atmosphere, or at least that we can say that it's consistent with having an ocean at this point in time. We're not at the point where we can say that definitively. So there are candidate exoplanets. So we know that they are there. That we say, okay, this could be a Hycean candidate based on this sort of mass-radius relationship and everything else that we kind of see from it, right? And so my job, though, when I study them, is to think about what the climate on those might look like, right?
So your role.
That's my role. I can't do the astronomy and I can't do the chemistry, right? And any of the other pieces of it. But we kind of, again, they can't do the oceanography, though, right? And so that's why we do this together, right? And it's because they have these really deep oceans, and I can tell you how that moves, right? And that, then, we can kind of think about how, then, that sets up exchange between that exoplanet's atmosphere and its ocean, potentially. And then that impacts what astronomers will see when they go and do spectroscopy of that planet's atmosphere. So they look... like transit spectroscopy, for example, where they kind of look at that background, like that host star's sunlight or light as it passes through that exoplanet's atmosphere. And that actually you can back out what's in it. So what is that atmosphere made of? And what that brings in this whole idea of biosignatures, which are sort of gases or things that exist within an exoplanet's atmosphere that we'd want to say are definitively something that's only produced by life. But it's really hard to say that something is definitively produced by life, because there's a lot of things out there, like oxygen, for example, that it can occur naturally. But like on our planet, we have almost, you know, we have like 21% oxygen in our atmosphere. We have that much oxygen because of life. So it can't always be a perfect biosignature. Like, we didn't always have oxygen in our atmosphere. Right. So when Earth was formed, there was no oxygen in it. It wasn't until life came up with photosynthesis and actually using carbon dioxide and then turning and having oxygen be a byproduct of that, that we started to actually have significant amounts of oxygen in our atmosphere. And it took a really long time. We're talking like billions of years still.
because the role here is to. Or the goal here is, there are a few things I think that are goals. One is to see if there's life somewhere else. But then the other goal is more of an evolutionary kind of thing, and being able to relate it to perhaps our own existence.
Yeah, so the hope too is that maybe we can learn something about our own existence or evolution of life on our own planet by potentially finding it or studying it elsewhere, or finding planets, for example, that are very early on in that process. That could be an analog for what very early Earth was like. So there's almost no geological record or rock or anything left from those time periods. So when we look that deep into the past, we have very little information, right? And so you have to have these multifaceted approaches where you're potentially looking at a different planet to learn something about your own and vice versa. You need models, you need proxies, you need people who go out and do field work, you need people who, you know, astronomers, chemists, you know, botanists, the whole nine yards. That's why, you know, again, why we're doing this, right? Everybody brings their little piece to help answer the big question.
And so is that what your lab, and by your lab, you might just say your lab is a collection of yourself, graduate students primarily?
Yeah, so it's me, and I have a very small lab. And I mean, realistically, because of my job being climate modeling or using climate models, I just need a supercomputer. So it's not usually even done here at the university. But I need my laptop. That's kind of all I need for my lab. So it's usually me and like a couple grad students. I have two and a half grad students right now. And then maybe one or two undergrads who are just interested in doing some kind of research and getting involved in that. Right. And so we'll either analyze output from climate models, or we'll think about running little simulations about, you know, what Earth could have looked like in the really deep past, or how an exoplanet might behave if you have different physical conditions, like if the planet's bigger, if it rotates faster, all of these sorts of things. And so we use computers as our toolbox to do that.
And you're training those folks. Mm-hmm. And they may, you're still pretty young, so you're training them, they will train others who will eventually replace you.
Yeah, definitely. That's the hope. But I mean, the idea is that I'm not training people to be my replacement, right? I'm training them to be their own person, right? And their own, to follow what's interesting to them in that way. So.
And you're doing this research and a lot of work in that, but you also teach.
Yes, I sure do.
And that's kind of I always thought it was the fun part of the job.
I love
when
it.
I was doing.
I love teaching and I love mentoring. Like we were talking earlier before we actually started the show, it's really the part of my job that gets me out of bed every day. I think it's a real honor to be able to guide the next generation of scientists, but also that they trust me enough to sort of put that process in my own, put the, you know, their well-being and their, you know, dreams in my hands as part of that. I think. It's definitely frustrating some days, right? But it's also a really magical piece about what we get to do is you get to help people figure out what really matters to them and what they want to do. And I really benefit a lot from being able to do that in my job.
Well, you're certainly a lot of fun to talk to. I bet it'd be fun to take your courses.
You should. I will school you in oceanography.
I'd probably fail miserably.
I don't know, Larry. I have hope for you.
Hannah Zanowski, assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Fun talking with her. And, you know, we're going to, you know, we were talking about exoplanets. We're going to talk about some planets out there where the robots, the rovers, have had some problems. And we've got a guy here who's kind of figured out how to solve that. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller. Let's move off into space for a little bit and take a look at a robot, rover, operating in one of those alien space worlds with our guests today. Because, you know, they we spend millions of dollars, or have spent millions and maybe billions, probably billions, to send spaceships with robots to other planets. And despite all the money, sometimes those unmanned vehicles can get stranded. And our next guest is here to tell us why and what he and other people have done to kind of solve the problem. Dan DeGroot is a professor of mechanical engineering in UW-Madison's College of Engineering. He and his team at the UW believe they have found flaws and maybe fixed flaws in how rovers are trained here on Earth, because we got to train them here before we send them off to Mars, for example. And it's some pretty cool research. And I hope you'll join the conversation. You can reach us with your own questions at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk at WPR.org. Dan DeGroot, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Larry, great to be here. An honor to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've kind of forgotten how long that we've been operating these rovers. It's been 50 years or a little more than 50 years.
More than that.
Yeah, 2009, the Mars rover Spirit got permanently stuck on the surface of the red planet. That was 2009. Has it improved since then?
So I want to believe that it has. And I think that one thing that people count more on these days is simulation.
Yeah.
And this is where our group at the university is chipping in. And you said at the start of the segment that we figured out something. I just want to clarify, it was a team effort. And I want to give credits where it's due. It was like a bunch of us. There were people, some people from NASA, some people from a small company in Pittsburgh, like a startup, great company, Pro Innovations. It was a really good friend from MIT. And there were some students from our lab. And in this mix, our role was like, to use computer simulation to basically look ahead to what happens when we're going to actually send this out to the moon. It was, by the way, the Viper rover. And that rover is supposed to go and probe, see, by now people know that there is ice on the moon in certain spots.
Yeah.
And they want to send this to get like clear confirmation that it is, this is how much it is, it's a dead depth, and so on. So that was the project back then, and there are like thousands of people whom I don't know that worked on this. So I'm a small part in a complex mechanism. But what our team was supposed to do was to figure out how you can control the motion of the wheels of the rover so they don't start spinning in place, because when that happens, it digs itself in, and then it ends up having the fate of the Spirit in 2009. So the people in industry, they were like looking at like, how do we control the motion of the wheels? We were supposed to simulate that, and basically it was like a team effort.
I say, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own situation. A couple of different times I've gotten stuck in my car, you know, and you just, the wheels spin, and pretty soon it's hung up on the base, and now you're not going anywhere.
So that's called 100% sleep. That's what it is. When you are like in Wisconsin, especially here in winter, basically your wheels turn and you go nowhere fast. When your speed is zero, longitudinal, translational, and the wheels spin a lot. That's 100% sleep. You don't want to be there. If you're there, probably it's like too late to do anything. So that's what they try to do, to control that, to prevent that from happening.
And what was there was a flaw.
Yeah, yeah. So here's what the thinking has been, and this is called gravitational offset. You offset the gravitational pull. So if you go to the moon, the gravitational pull is 1/6 ballpark of what's on Earth.
Okay.
So then people are like doing things like, okay, look, we have a rover. Let's start shedding parts to the point where the mass is 1/6 of what's going to be when we actually send the rover to the moon. Okay, this was one approach. A second approach is like, let's attach a helium balloon to the rover to lift it, offset the weight. Another one is to take a crane and lift it like lightly so all of these things, that's how it was done. And then you take the rover, for instance, go to the Mojave Desert, or sometimes you have like a lunar simulant, it's called like GRC-1, on a certain terrain. And then you look at how it moves, like 1/6 the mass.
Yeah.
And then you say like, oh, okay, well, on the moon, it's going to weigh 1/6. So the pressure on the terrain is going to be like here. So therefore, whatever we see here is going to what we see there. But the problem with that is that you have to basically pay attention to what happened to the terrain, the granular material that this rover moves on. And this is where the tricky part is. And let me spend 30 seconds just giving you an example that can serve as like a preamble to the discussion. So imagine that we have like a deck of cards, or like, for instance, like a stack of bricks. Let's say a stack of bricks.
Okay.
Like, or cards. We have 52 cards. We have like some bricks. We put them here in front of us on the table in between you and me. And let's say that like 10 bricks. And I tell you, Larry, extract brick number 8, which is pretty close to the table, right?
Yeah.
One is the top one.
Yeah.
So then you start pulling and you extract it, okay? So now here's what I do. Now I say like, hey, do it again, but I'm going to go to the top brick and I'm going to start pressing on it. It's going to be harder for you to pull the brick, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Good. So here is why this is related to what happens there. So on the moon, it's not like me pushing on the top of the top brick.
Yeah.
But the gravitational pull is lower, so it pulls all those bricks with a lower force. So therefore, it's easy for you to pull out the 8th brick. Does it make sense?
Okay, yes.
Or if I go and I press with an infinite amount of force, you can never take that brick out because the friction force is mu times the normal force. Okay, so that's what comes into play. On the moon, there's nothing to pull down really hard the terrain that you move on, right? The gravitational pull is 1/6. If you take this on Earth, here the terrain is pulled down hard so you don't shear. And if you don't shear, your slip basically is low so you can move. So that's basically the basic observation. It's just like how the terrain shears because there the terrain is more fluffy, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it shears more easily. So therefore, you have a tendency of getting stuck more up there than down here. It's as simple as that in retrospect.
Well, it took a while, and you guys had to do simulation work. I mean, how did your teams simulate how a rover works on desert sand on Earth versus Mars
okay,
or someplace else?
So with a simulator, basically, there's like a modeling part, right? You formulate some equations that govern the motion of the parts that you're talking about. Like, for instance, let me give you an example. Like, let's say you have like a die or like a pair of dice, like two dice, and you throw them, right? And they tumble in air, and it's clear that's gravity pulling down, and they turn. There's some, like, Newton's second law, basically, right?
Yeah.
They hit the ground, there's a force there. You compute that force based on the model. You integrate some equations of motion. You can figure out how the dice roll. It's the same thing on a different scale. For granular material, you don't have two dice. You have, like, literally in 1 cubic meter of sand is probably, like, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion elements. So that's one way to do it. There are other ways to simplify. But long story short, you can predict through simulation how these components, including the rover, will move. So basically with this project, about like probably now it's like 3 years ago, So we were working with the people from NASA Glenn next to Cleveland, and that's where the thermomechanics lab is. And they said, like, look, how about like simulate this single wheel, because that's how you start. You don't start with a full vehicle. You start with a wheel. So, look, we have tests in the lab, and the results look like this. Can you simulate the single wheel? Oh yeah, we simulated the single wheel. The results came pretty close. Okay, and said, like, okay, now simulate the entire vehicle, but it's 1/6 the mass. Okay, we model, you produce a CAD geometry representation of the vehicle. We simulated that 1/6 mass of the vehicle. The results look, oh, okay, look, it looks good. But now at this point, and this is the interesting part, in about 5 seconds, you can change like one line of code and you change the gravitational pull for 1/6, whatever is on the moon, multiply by 6, you get 9.81 meters per second square. And then you run your simulation basically either on Earth or on moon with basically one line of change. One change of line. And then we said first, like, okay, look, we got the 1/6 mass results here. And then now, let's go back to the original rover, put the normal mass, and switch the gravity to lunar gravity to see, you know, out of curiosity, are the results the same? And the results were not the same. So then you start thinking, and here, like, Ken, this friend from MIT, so, like, look, in about, like, I think in 1930s, there were some scaling laws that explain how if you change the size of the rover or, like, you know, the size of the mass of the rover, you can start telling how the forces are. They're called scaling laws. And I don't know, to use an analogy, is the same thing, for instance, like Boeing, when they build an airplane, they do not test the big airplane. They test in a wind tunnel a scaled down version.
Sure.
And there are certain laws that tell you what the forces on the big guy are based on the little guy.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing here. It turns out that there are some laws that you can apply to figure out some relationship. And Ken said, like, okay, let's look at those laws and what they say. And also they'll say, like, oh, look, the simulation that you got with the full vehicle, with the full mass, should be this. So therefore, your simulation is okay, and there's a discrepancy. And then we started thinking about things, and that was our conclusion. Like, okay, there is a gap, and here's the problem. The problem is that, okay, there's a small error there. Unfortunately, the error makes you be optimistic about the performance of the rover, because sometimes you make a mistake on the other side. You are too conservative. But here you say, oh, yeah, it's going to work just fine. And actually, you know, is that like, I cannot tell that the Spirit rover got stuck because of this. But it's a good thing to know, pay attention to, and account for it.
Well, your team used an open source physics simulation engine.
Yes.
Called Chrono.
Yes.
So this is Project Chrono. And this open source means it's free for anybody to use.
Yes.
This is something you guys developed?
Yes. So here's the story with that one. In 1998, a friend from Italy, who's now, back then he was a student, now he's a professor at the University of Parma, Alessandro Tassora, he started that. And in 2007, I started working with him. We started working as a lab on that. So since 2007, we have developed that for, what, now it's 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been very fortunate. And we had funding from the Army, funding from NASA, funding from National Science Foundation, and we kept going. So the software is open source and is also released under what is called a BSD3 license, which means that anybody, Larry, you included, can take it, edit it, sell it, make money out of it, do whatever you want. You have a product, you can take, copy and paste parts of it. But that's how the software is. And there are like a bunch of people working on that in the lab. I want to say, honestly, these days, the amount of code that I write is minimal. But there are people in the lab. I have colleagues, two scientists, Radu and Luning. I have like in the lab, work together as a team, probably like 20 people, probably like 15 grad students and such. And we do research, but eventually that research is funneled into the code in some shape or form. And the code this simulator is basically what is called the multi-physics simulator. You can do rovers, but by the same token, we look at the granular flow in a heat exchanger to understand what the design, an optimal design is to improve the efficiency, how you produce electricity from solar energy. So it has all sorts of, like, you can simulate like the flow of fluids and such. Long story short, it's an open source package that we develop in collaboration with colleagues from Italy, and we also used for our projects. And they're like literally thousands of people out there in the world. Like, there are people using it in Japan, in France.
China, I bet.
Probably. Actually, yes. Because a former student, for instance, now is faculty there. But, you know, that's the way, with, you know, it's open source. It's there for anyone to use it and, you know, put it to hopefully good use.
So, and by the way, just as an aside here while we're talking, I know it has been used in a number of ways. I mean, I think it was even involved, I was trying to think, in mechanical watches.
Yes. Yes.
As an example. So, I mean, somebody listening today might have an engine or might have whatever product. I would think it would be open to many products, tractors.
Yes.
Vehicles of all sorts.
Yep.
So the simulator, the Chrono project then was able to come up with a design, or was it?
The simulator, basically, whatever design you have is going to simulate its evolution. It's the way it moves in the real world. The design, how you do it, it's up to you. But at that point, once you have a design and you are curious about how it's going to, for instance, I know that it has been used for a rover that next year is going to go to Phobos, which is a moon of Mars. So people probably used it to understand how they should design the wheel so that the rover can operate in that environment. The wheel has a certain shape. They define the shape. The gravitational pull there is about probably more than 1,000 times lower than on Earth. So they have to move extremely slowly, like 1 millimeter per second or something like that, to engage with the soil, because the soil is super fluffy and it's hard to move on that. But you can run these simulations and understand how your system behaves. And if you're not happy with it, then you go change the design and you run the simulation again. And in the real world, what you do, literally, you run thousands of simulations like that. Also, we have a collaborator, very close collaborator at Carnegie Mellon. They are going to send the Moon Ranger this year, should go to the moon. They've been using the software for probably like years now, and they rely on it, and they gain insights from it. Is that what's going to happen on the moon? You know, you never know that. But that's why you don't write a simulation. You run thousands of simulations to see, hey, what if the friction coefficient is that? Or what if I change the slope on which this moves to that? So you start getting some insights into how this system is going to behave once it lands on, you know, the moon, or like our moon, or the moon of Mars, and so on.
So it's less likely that is going to be much less likely to get stuck.
That's the idea, yes.
If it does get stuck, can you back out of it? I mean,
yes, the answer is, like, at that point, you generate a model of the rover. Basically, it already did sink to some extent, and you try to see, like, okay, what sort of control policy should I try now? What sort of torque, what sort of angular velocity should I try on the wheels to see if I can get it out of there? So that's basically the idea.
So how, and this simulation software, I assume it's got to be constantly or often updated.
All the time.
Putting in, from what you learn, you add additional.
Yep.
How significant is it for, here we've got a public university, University of Wisconsin, how significant is it for a public university to develop software of this sort?
That's a good question. For me, personally, it's very important, and it means a lot to me. In academia, if you write software, probably you're not going to get tenure if you do just that. You need to publish something out of it. So it's a little bit challenging. So because we try to do something where you write software, you debug it, you profile it, you write documentation, you do unit testing, you release it, you support it. We have a user forum which has more than 700 people who ask questions and such. The good thing is that there is many of us, and people are, I would say, like, super dedicated, and they have great fun doing this. I think that INET, once you have this feeling that, okay, your work makes a difference, it's a lot of fun, and you are very motivated. And I feel like that's how the people in the lab are, and that's why it's fun to go to work every day.
Well, what is AI? What role does AI play?
Okay, so we talked about rovers.
Yeah.
But here is something that probably, I think, is going to get bigger, and it has to do with what is called embodied AI, like a robot, like a humanoid robot.
Mm-hmm.
It has what is called, like, if you can think about it, like an autonomy stack, like a brain. So it has some sensors. It has, like, I don't know, I'm just making this up. Let's say 4 cameras, 3 IMUs, some LiDAR, whatever. But there are some sensing feeds that it gets. And this autonomy stack, it gets this information and it decides what the next action is, such as move forward or turn left or whatever. Yeah. So here's the basic idea. The basic idea is that you're trying to design the brain of the robot or whatever agent you have. And it's much more effective to do it in simulation because it's okay to make mistakes in simulation.
Yeah.
It's not that we've worked with Tesla. We do have students interning. There's students right now interning at Tesla and another one going out next month. But it's not like we're working with Tesla, but just imagine this. If they do a radical change in their autonomy stack, you don't want to put a pedestrian in front of a Tesla vehicle to say, like, is this patch good or bad? You can simulate many of these things before you actually
do it.
Because that's very cost effective. To run a physical experiment is expensive. You have, like, cloud computing now. I can launch 1,000 experiments tomorrow morning, all of them are done, right? That's the basic idea. So that's why I think that with the advent of AI, a lot of the role of simulation, I mean, is going to be great, I think.
Fascinating work, Dan. I want to thank you. I mean, the time flew by here. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about your really cool research, and I hope we can talk again. Thank you. Again.
Larry, it's been an honor, pleasure, and hopefully we'll cross paths again in the future.
I hope so. Dan DeGroot, professor of mechanical engineering in UW-Madison's College of Engineering, has done some really cool work. We're going to come back to Earth and take a look at what's going on in the water with algae. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, summer in Wisconsin means spending time on the lake or the river, maybe warm, sunny days. You boat, you water ski, you fish. Unfortunately, summer also brings some toxic algae blooms and frequent beach closures. Larry Mueller here talking today with Gina La Liberty, who is a coordinator of statewide harmful algal bloom and inland beach monitoring. That's a big title here for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Maybe swimming beaches near you have closed for the summer or part of the summer because of blue-green algal blooms. Do you know how to protect yourself and local lakes from toxic algae? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Gina, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, Larry.
What has it been, a long time, 30 years? Have you been doing that long, studying Wisconsin lakes?
I've been with the Wisconsin DNR since 2000. I actually started out looking at kind of the ancient history of lakes, taking sediment cores and reconstructing nutrient histories based on some types of algae fossils in those sediments. And then I moved on to streams, and then now I'm working on lakes, blue-green algae blooms.
Oh, so you've got a lot of experience here. You know the history. How harmful are, how long have they been around, those blooms?
Well, I would say literally blue-green algal blooms have been around for about 2.5 to 3 billion years. They're why we have the oxygen atmosphere that we have now. In Wisconsin, the earliest bloom record that I have found was in 1895, I believe, in Lake Mendota and Monona. So the lakes here were getting things like sewage pumped into them directly, and that that fed the blooms in those times.
Yeah. So what is the makeup of a bloom like that, a blue-green?
Well, blue-green algae, their scientific name is cyanobacteria, and that reflects the fact that they're actually true bacteria. They get lumped in with algae because they photosynthesize, just like plants and true algae do. But they're really bacteria. And the blue-green part of the name comes from some of the blue pigments that are contained within the cells that we normally don't see if they're actively growing, but we do see kind of a turquoise color sometimes when blooms die and decompose and those cells break open.
Yeah. And your role, talk about a little more about what do you do in your role as DNR statewide harmful algal bloom coordinator?
Well, the coordinator position, it sounds like I arrange blooms to happen, and that's really not the case. That would be a very interesting superpower. But I lead the DNR's communication and response around blooms. So one of the big parts of my job, especially this time of year, is getting bloom reports from the public. We have an email address on our DNR website, dnrhabs@wisconsin.gov, where people can submit reports of blooms occurring in a lake. And one thing that really helps me to verify whether they're seeing a blue-green algal bloom or something different is that they submit photographs. I can tell from a photograph whether it is a blue-green algal bloom or something else. And sometimes it is something else.
Yeah, is that a good thing?
Yeah.
Maybe or probably.
It can be a good thing. Well, I really like the fact that people are going to the lake and looking at conditions and wondering what something is. And that usually gives them pause if it looks like a blue-green algal bloom. But sometimes it's things like pollen. So I got a lot of pollen reports this spring. Pollen's usually a light yellow color. It can accumulate in scums on the surface of lakes and rivers, just like a blue-green algal bloom might. But if you see that yellow pollen coating surfaces on land, that's kind of a cue that that yellow stuff on the water is probably pollen.
And this blue-green algae is really harmful, or can be really harmful.
Yes, some blue-green algae can be harmful. So there are some species that have the ability to produce toxins. Not all of them do, and even those that have that ability to make those toxins don't make them all the time. And where the harmful part of it comes in is with exposure. So people and animals are exposed if they're swallowing blue-green algae in water. So people, if they're accidentally swimming, animals, if they're intentionally drinking from a lake. You can have some aerosol exposure, too. For example, if you're water skiing or tubing across a lake, that the boat that's towing you is kicking up a lot of spray and you inhale that spray.
Yeah, I can remember that from my water skiing days. Sucking it in, yep. Sucking water in, and hopefully not the blue-green algae. So I'm thinking, actually, what comes to mind right away for me is wildlife, like deer or anything else. Beaver, anything that uses the water.
Yeah.
And we have no way of really knowing, I would guess, the potential harm that is done to those animals.
Right. It would be really difficult to try to assess that. I mean, you can put signs up at a beach and people will read them and hopefully protect their pets, but obviously wildlife aren't going to pay attention to that.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how widespread is it? Is that blue-green bloom in Wisconsin? How bad is it this summer, and how bad has it been?
Well, just to take a general step back, so blue-green algae, they live in every water body in Wisconsin. There are actually some that grow on land, too. I've seen mud puddles in my neighborhood that have blue-green algae kind of growing on the sediments. So they're in every aquatic system in at least small levels. Where we typically see blooms happening are in water bodies that have high nutrient levels. So phosphorus and nitrogen, those are nutrients that can fertilize the growth of plants, of algae, or blue-green algae. So if we've got a lot of those nutrients in water, you can potentially have a lot of blue-green algae growing.
Yeah, and I would think that we're going to, you look in maybe urban areas more, or is it rural areas? Are you likely to see it more?
Well, I get bloom reports from really all throughout the state. I get the most bloom reports, and we know that the most blooms are occurring in these nutrient-enriched water bodies. But occasionally I'll get bloom reports from, say, really clear, low-nutrient lakes in northern Wisconsin. And in those cases, it's most often sort of a physical cause for those blooms. If you get a few days of really calm conditions, blue-green algae, at least the planktonic blue-green algae, can float to the surface. And then wind can then blow them all to the downwind shore. So in those cases, it's more the wind that's really causing that bloom to accumulate at the shore. And that's also because, like, blue-green algae have really wide growing tolerances. Some have to have those high nutrients, some don't tolerate the nutrients, and they like lower nutrient systems. So they're really diverse in what their preferences are. So in those cases, you might have a lake with low nutrients, and you just have different species of blue-green algae there.
And they may not be as harmful in a way, or are they just as harmful?
I would say, in general, the major bloom species are the ones that tend to grow in these really nutrient-enriched systems. Less so the species that grow in the lower nutrient systems.
So who decides that a beach needs to be closed because of the algae?
Well, in Wisconsin, that jurisdiction lies with the local health department. So if I get a bloom or the folks monitoring the beach let me know about a bloom, I work with the public health department, determine that, yes, that is a blue-green algae bloom at the beach. In some cases, like in Madison, Public Health Madison-Dane County actually has a capacity to monitor for algal toxins at our beaches. But that's really not the case with most public health departments throughout the state, and they can close a beach just based on visual observation of a bloom at a beach.
And if you've got your dog swimming in one of those, that can kill the dog or the person, I guess.
Well, the dog is... It would probably be a situation where you can visually see a bloom. If you just don't know what that is and the dog drinks the water that contains the bloom, that's an exposure route for them. And since animals, because of their smaller body size and their tendency to drink more of the water, or dogs will actually groom the blue-green algae from their fur after they get out of the water, they have a higher exposure, unfortunately. And we have had some very serious illnesses in dogs, and actually, unfortunately, some dog deaths in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Gina LaLiberty, our guest today. Gina LaLiberty is the coordinator of statewide harmful algae bloom and inland beach monitoring for our Wisconsin DNR. Questions for her, maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at algae blooms on the show today with our guest, Gina LaLiberty, who is coordinator of statewide harmful algae bloom and inland beach monitoring for our Wisconsin DNR. Questions for her, or maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. I had an email from Jill to say that makes a statement. Pesticides, herbicides, and synthetic fertilizers can harm a lot of things. Pollinators, birds, aquatic life, even people and pets. They also wash into our waterways and contribute, she guesses, to algae blooms and ecosystem damage. And says this is well documented by environmental research. Why aren't they banned?
Why aren't they banned? That's a good question. There has to be political will to ban them, and they do serve some purposes. I would say that, yeah, fertilizers can contribute to algal blooms. They fertilize their growth. But things like herbicides, too. There's been some research that indicates that blue-green algae are less susceptible to herbicides than other types of algae. So they can, if herbicides are washing in from the land, they can kind of inadvertently give algal blooms a boost.
Yeah. So what do you do if, well, first, who's at the greatest health risk to something like this?
For algal blooms, it would depend on who you are, what you're doing, and how much of that water you're swallowing. So for things like swimming, if you're immersing your head, little kids are at the greatest risk. They spend more time in the water. They might not be as good at keeping water out of their mouth. They might intentionally drink the water. Same with dogs. Dogs are going to intentionally drink that water, and that's an exposure route. It's less of a risk if you're doing something where you're not sticking your head and your face in the water, because you're at a lower risk of accidentally swallowing that water. So something like kayaking or fishing is going to be a much lower risk.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking about my kids when they were little. I'd see them putting their hands in the water and then sticking their hand in their mouth.
Yep. Yep. Hand to mouth.
Hand to mouth. Well, how susceptible to getting sick are dogs that swim in the water?
Well, that would depend on like how concentrated that bloom is that they're exposed to, and whether that bloom is actually making toxins. It's kind of the complicated thing that you can't tell if a bloom is making toxins just by looking at it. You would have to actually test it. So in general, it's just really a good idea if you see an algal bloom in the water, which would normally look like tiny green particles. In some cases, they look like little green grass clippings. There are also some sort of tan pinhead-sized blobs that might be a bloom. But there are also other types of blue-green algae that normally grow on lake bottoms, and they can float up off the bottom. They tend to be sort of a dark color, sometimes a very, very dark green or even a teal color. So floating mats like that might be an exposure route for dogs, like if they like to kind of snap at things floating on the water.
Yeah. I was thinking about research or work that's been done in sort of this Madison watershed and the rivers coming in to kind of do things to mitigate agricultural pollution, for example, as it comes in. Have we had much success with that?
I think you have to remember that this is it's a long process. We've been putting nutrients into at least the Madison Lake since the 1800s. And I look at it like cleaning up after a really raucous party. It takes probably longer to clean it up than it does to mess things up. But things like that Suck the Muck initiative, in which the really nutrient-rich sediments are being dredged out of some of the tributaries to the Madison Lakes, that's a really important effort.
Yeah, I would think so. But also, just right here in any urban setting, I mean, there's plenty of reason to believe that the pollution can be greater even from a city like Madison than maybe even the farms.
I think there's been some research that shows overall, since we have such a big watershed that includes a lot of agriculture, agriculture is the primary input to the Madison Lakes, but I think the things that Madison and Monona residents can do to mitigate those impacts is important. So even things like keep making sure you rake the leaves out of the gutter and keep them from washing down storm drains, because they can be a significant input of phosphorus to lakes in the fall.
Yeah. Do you have somebody else is wondering about experiences that you may have had with particularly bad ones over time?
Sure. Well, blue-green algal blooms, if they are really big, really intense, and they're decomposing, they can be really stinky. And in some cases, people mistake them for, I think there was a bloom on the Fox River that was decomposing. It was a really bright turquoise color, and someone had reported it to DNR and thought it was a spill from a porta potty because it smelled like sewage and it had that bright blue color, but it actually was a blue-green algal bloom in the Fox River that was decomposing.
Oh, and how does it dissipate? I mean, you know, it's there and then it's over time, I suppose, it's gone, but what happens?
Well, the populations will naturally die off. A lot of times when you have a bloom forming on the surface, those cells, those colonies are getting a lot more UV light than they're used to, maybe further down in the water. So that stresses them out. They're getting a lot warmer than they are further down in the water. So a lot of these things will eventually lead to them dying and just decomposing. And there are a lot of decomposing bacteria, and they're actually viruses too that can break open blue-green algae cells and lead to their death.
Oh, and when they're dead, then they're not a problem?
For the most, I would say that, yeah, for the most part, they're not a problem. Where they might be an issue is if there were toxins present in that bloom, and those toxins are then released into the water.
Brian in Two Rivers emailed to say they've noticed that when there are wavy conditions, area beaches in Two Rivers area occasionally have algae or a type of seaweed that seems to hover just below the waterline. It is slimy and green. It is usually just for a few feet at the shore, and then the water clears. Is it... And Brian wonders, is it safe to walk through this particular bloom?
Yeah, what Brian's seeing at Two Rivers on Lake Michigan is a green alga called cladophora. It normally grows attached to things on the bottom, and that which used to be rocks, but now it grows on quagga mussels out in Lake Michigan. Which is a non-native mussel that's invaded the Great Lakes system, and it essentially farms cladophora. The cladophora grows on the shells. They recycle nutrients really close to the bottom that the cladophora takes up, and by filtering, they've really cleared up Lake Michigan. So Lake Michigan's a lot clearer than it used to be, so there's more of the bottom where sunlight can reach cladophora. So cladophora's really been taken off in the last 10 to 20 years in Lake Michigan.
Yeah, yeah. And that's not good. Well, in a lot of ways, or is it?
Well, it's completely changed the ecology of Lake Michigan. And then when it comes to our beaches, cladophora kind of goes through a midsummer sloughing event where a lot of the strands of the algae break off break off the bottom and they can get washed in by waves and especially by storms. So when all of this deposits on a beach, there's sometimes some mussels that wash up and seagulls will poke around in there and forage on the mussels and poop, and the cladophora mats washed up on the beach kind of incubate those fecal bacteria. So you've got this kind of nasty little system where you can have higher bacteria counts right around these cladophora mats.
Barb emailed, how does the presence of algal blooms in our lakes compare with algal blooms in other cities? She recently saw an article about New York beaches being closed for algal blooms.
Yeah, I would say that we're kind of on par. We do have some issues with some of our large impoundments. I think Wisconsin tends to have more more sort of impoundment type lakes than at least for, compared to Michigan. So anytime you put a dam on a river, it slows down the flow. You can have nutrients and sediments depositing, and that can tend to lead to more algal blooms in those systems.
How does I'm wondering about salt. I mean, I'm thinking about ways that we can reduce algal blooms. And does salt play a role in blooms?
Well, just like the...
I'm still thinking road salt for salt.
Just like the herbicides we talked about. So road salt can wash into lakes, and just like the herbicides, blue-green algae are less susceptible to chloride and road salt than other more desirable types of algae. So that's another thing that inadvertently can be giving them a boost in our lakes.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things, what are some other things that we might do just as homeowners that that could help mitigate this problem?
Well, I think if you don't live on a lake, but obviously we all live within a watershed of a lake or a river, just anything that you can do to keep those nutrients on the land where you are. So you can do something like installing a rain garden, for example. Especially around Madison, there's promotions for keeping the lakes leaf-free, so making sure that you keep fallen leaves out of the gutters, so that's not contributing nutrients to the lakes in the fall. But for folks who actually live on lakeshore properties, making sure you're reducing as runoff from your property as much as possible. So there are a lot of things that you can do, including planting native plants along the shoreline, for example.
Yeah, that would that really helps. Julie emailed here with something about a mechanical thing. She has a camper in Chautauqua, and the place across the street had horrible algae. It almost caused vomiting. Julie said the new property owners had some kind of machine that cleaned it up, and wondered what the heck kind of machine was that.
That's a good question, and I can't answer that. It's not even sure if it's something technically permitted for use in Wisconsin.
Well, it would be something that would roil the water, perhaps.
That can be a problem. I know there are some devices that are designed to do that, but you have to be absolutely sure you're not stirring up the sediments too, because A, you're passing the problem along down the shore to the neighbors, and B, if you're roiling up the sediment, that's just adding nutrients into the lake. Yeah. So that's a problem.
So I want to go back before we close here to the web. There's a website that people can go to check on conditions. Let's say you're going to go somewhere in north of Wisconsin, or maybe you're in the north and want to come south and want to know what the condition is. How do they get that information?
That would be the Wisconsin Beach Health website. We actually have a map that has beach conditions, advisories, closures, et cetera, on it. And I can't remember the email address right off the top of my head. But if you search for Wisconsin Beach Health Map, that will have that. That is mostly based on bacteria monitoring at beaches.
Okay. Well, Gina, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. The time flew by. Appreciate it very much.
Okay. Thank you, Larry.
Gina LaLiberty is the coordinator of statewide harmful algae bloom and inland beach monitoring for our DNR. It's great to have her with us. And great to have you listening in as well. And big thanks to our whole team, Clara Nyper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, of course, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in shore here on WPR News.